Hi, this is Paul Gillen of Newspaper Death Watch. On Tuesday, September 23rd, I had the opportunity to sit down for about an hour with John Yema, the editor-in-chief of the Christian Science Monitor. John is a veteran reporter and editor from the Boston Globe who made the move over to the Monitor only a couple of months ago. And he has some interesting ideas and visions about the role that the Monitor will play in the global world of media and how the newspaper will evolve to become a multimedia force. So we talked a lot about journalism, about publishing, about the role of newspapers, about the benefits and losses that will result from the destruction of much of the print newspaper industry. And I think you'll find his comments very interesting. They're presented here unedited, about a one-hour interview, as I said. So here is my interview with John Yema.
I saw Alex Beam's column a few weeks ago on the Monitor, which was remarkable because Alex Beam never says nice things about anyone.
That's true.
And see, you're doing this 100-year promotion, and seem to have a you seem to know what you want to be here, which I think a lot of newspapers don't. So this is my book, my first book, but I leave that with you
Great.
About this phenomenon about how new technology is disrupting the publishing mainstream. And so I wanted to talk to you about what's different about the journal, about where you guys are going as you pass this 100-year mark, and also about your perspective as a veteran news guy and what's happening to the industry. I thought I'd record this. I'd like to put the recording on the blog.
Sure.
I get a lot of traffic from other publishers, so they're probably interested in hearing what you're doing right.
That'd be great. I mean, I think the core need right now is to preserve the mission of newspapers, and that's the central editorial mission. And I think that the problem is the business, and you put your finger on it, the problem is the business model is broken.
Right.
So I think we all realize that a world of aggregation, a world of commentary, a world of blogging is great, but that having a core group of people who are dedicated to looking at the world objectively as possible and trying to bring in primary source information to public discourse, that takes a certain amount of capital investment. That takes a certain amount of talent collection, and you got to hold that talent together. And that means, in the case of the Globe, where I used to work, that means a very strong local base, right? A base of people at City Hall, a base of people at the State House, a base of people on the streets of Boston who are covering stories in Boston. And at the Christian Science Monitor, our mission is really to global journalism. So one of our commitments is to our overseas operations. We have eight foreign bureaus, bureaus in other countries. We have a fairly substantial Washington staff and bureaus throughout the United States. And the key is to hold that operation together and to let it thrive. But it's really, to me, not that important what the actual means of delivery is. The means of delivery have evolved over 100 years at the Monitor and over, more than 100 years at other newspapers. I mean, they've moved from horse-drawn wagons to trucks to news carriers to, and to the internet and so moving more significantly into web delivery, which I think we already have at the Monitor, the Globe already has with Boston.com, but shifting even more in that direction and putting more resources into development of the web, where people are really spending into web journalism, where people are really spending their time. They're reading more and more, there's a different expectation on the web too. The form of storytelling changes because of the medium. So you can't just do newspaper.com online. You have to learn multimedia storytelling. And we're pretty good at that here, but we have a long way to go. And so I just want to try to get our skill set up and our assets allocated much more strongly toward the web. It'll be a here and other places, I think. For now, it'll be a multi-platform. Frankly, always it'll be a multi-platform strategy because print lives. It just is not as healthy as it once was. Going forward, I'm not even sure that a pure website application is the way you're really going to be getting your news. I mean, you're going to be looking at it mobile. Somebody's going to develop some new technology that's going to, so the idea that the old paradigm was print delivered to your doorstep, and that was it. And the new paradigm is somehow just the web, I think, is also false. It's that the new paradigm is change, constant change in new media. And so what we're trying to do at the Monitor, and again, I'm saying that other newspapers are trying to do this too, but we have possibly the advantage of being a little bit more flexible because of the way we're organized. What we're trying to do is give ourselves maximum flexibility so that we can deliver the news where people are, where how people are consuming it. Right now, that means a much stronger internet presence.
You mentioned international. The catchphrase in newspaper publishing these days is hyper-local, and you are anything but that.
Right.
What is the Monitor's role in the spectrum of publishers, news publishers? What is the Monitor's mm-hmm. role? How does the international coverage play to that?
Well, I think it's not a one-size-fits-all type industry. In fact, I think that the proper role for a locally based newspaper, one that has the name of a city in its nameplate, the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald, is to emphasize local coverage. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't have national or international coverage in different ways, but their bread and butter has to be the local community in which they exist. Now, our mandate was different from that. Our mandate was not local coverage to begin. So we were an internationally oriented newspaper from practically the inception. Mm-hmm. Turns out that complementing, in a world where people would consume 1 to 5 newspapers back in the old days, that was the primary means of getting your news. The Monitor could fit into that. You could be reading the Boston Globe and you could be reading the Monitor. You know that that's been that phenomenon of consuming a lot of different news sources is really amplified on the web, where people can simply move through quickly. So if you're getting your local news primarily from a local news carrier, you're going to want, I think, another way of understanding the world. You're still going to be interested in international news, particularly as it pertains to Americans who are trying to understand the world. You know, an environmental story or an energy story are good examples of that. Some of those are international news stories. They generally start as international news stories, but they have a local impact. So we kind of see our role as the human impact of global events. We try to humanize things. It's not just the self-interest of Americans. It's also understanding other cultures so that you can understand what motivates them. I mean, what's behind an insurgent movement or a conflict in Northern Africa. I mean, there's a lot of interest in international news, and I think that we act as a kind of a complement to a hyper-local strategy. As newspapers become a lot more polarized in that sense, so that local newspapers really concentrate more locally, more hyper-locally, it gives us a good space, I think, and a few other players a good space to work in.
Yeah, well, which begs the question, I mean, you've got, you know, with the exception of a few papers like these guys, you've got dramatic cutbacks in international bureaus. Washington bureaus are being savaged, and newspapers themselves just can't afford to staff these staff these far-flung operations. Does this make your role more important in this ecosystem?
Well, I think so. You only have to look at the cutbacks which you've written about other news services, of say their Washington bureaus or the shutting down of their foreign operations, to see that the role of an independent group of journalists looking at things. The New York Times does a great job, and the Washington Post does a great job, but having another set of eyes and ears out there looking at parts of the world that used to be covered by multiple players and now have dwindled to a handful. And we have people in Baghdad right now. And the number of reporters of news organizations that have people in Baghdad has really shrunk. So that's just a way of keeping an eye on things. Multiple perspectives can only help.
Speaking to the business issue, because as you said, the business model, what's wrong with newspapers is not what they do, but the business model is not sustainable anymore. Your business, to what degree are you expected to hit a P&L, and do you, or are you able to function without that kind of pressure?
Well, we've had the luxury for the past 50 years, but increasingly as time has gone on, of having the Christian Science Church subsidize our operations. We are part of the Christian Science Church. And is there one of their missions as a church is simply to publish this globally oriented objective, other than, as you know, if you've read the Monitor, other than one religious article, it is a secular in its presentation, although generally looking at solution-oriented journalism rather than shock and awe journalism. So that's been the Monitor's ethos throughout, and because the church has subsidized us, we've been able to continue our mission. But as time has gone on, that subsidy has become rather large, and our idea is to try to create a sustainable model. So that we will be able to carry out our journalistic mission without having to go back and ask for more money from the church.
So when you came in here, was one of your objectives to rationalize a business model that would not require these subsidies? I mean, are you trying to make the Monitor self-sustaining, or is that not expected?
We are trying to make it self-sustaining, and I think we have a pretty good plan. Remember, I've only been on the job 2 months, so I can't take credit for all of this. There's been some intensive work done over probably over the past couple of decades, but probably more intensively over the past couple of years to try to figure out a new business model. And by the way, this is not anything that isn't happening elsewhere. At the Globe, when I left, they were deeply into a strategic review. Every newspaper is looking at, trying to re-engineer its business model. So the Monitor was doing that too. And coming out of that and, kind of going forward, we're trying to refine our plan so that we can move to a sustainable basis. So our aim would be, not tomorrow or not next year, but over some reasonable number of years. And we're somewhat insulated from the market because we're nonprofit. It doesn't mean that we don't feel the pain of spending of increases in costs or of decreases in or the potential decreases in funding. So over, I would say 3 to 5 years, we're hoping to move toward a sustainable model, and we're developing a business plan along those lines, and that's happening I'm involved, but that's happening with other players here who are in the publishing side and who are directing the whole operation.
And when you look at where that model may be, talking about the balance of online and print, and maybe other operations, I don't know. What, 3 years out, what does that model, what does that mix look like?
Well, I think print has a role, but I think that a stronger web presence, and if you look at the success, and I'm not saying that we model ourselves on them, but you look at the success of, say, the Huffington Post, or you look at the success of even
Politico.
Yeah,
right.
There is a model that works, basically I would say this, that while we want to do everything we can to achieve growth on the print side, and we're going to keep working on that, the greatest potential for growth is on the website, and the quickest route to it, or the best route to it, is to do Monitor journalism with all the quality that is known, that's been developed over 100 years, but to do it more energetically on the web. The trick is that if you have a website that is updated multiple times during a day with news that's relevant for people. And monitored news is not just, wow, an explosion. It's what's behind that explosion. Or what's yeah. So we don't have to be on top of the story the minute it breaks, but if within the news cycle we are there with an analytical, thoughtful piece, we already know that we're of huge value. I mean, Google News loves monitor-type stories, and they don't necessarily expect monitor-type stories to be there with the AP at the and Reuters the moment an event occurs. But sometime within the next 6 to 8 hours, if we put something up on our blogs that are, you know, that attempts to explain what's going on behind a political or an economic event, will often be aggregated by them. And, you know, so people look for, and search engines are very interested in monitor type stories because we tend to write these definitive stories. You know, I mentioned Darfur the other day. We've probably explained what's behind the conflict in Darfur, you know, 10 or 15 times over the past 3 or 4 years. And if you do a web search, what are the Janjaweed and in Darfur, you're likely to find a monitor article in that because they tend to be definitive articles, not just the latest article, which doesn't really show up that well in a good Google search. And monitor content is well linked because of the quality of it. So all of those things together already give us a good platform. And, of course, we've got a great name and a great brand. The key is to make the website much more of a go-to destination. The website's pretty good. It's got good traffic, but it's punching under its weight right now. It needs to be, because ultimately you want people to experience your product as a whole and not just in its sliced off pieces as articles. It's difficult. It's not just for the Monitor, but it's difficult for other newspapers, including the Times and the Post, to convert people from an article from a search that lands you on an article page to actually exploring the website. And there are all kinds of graphical and linking techniques that you try to use when you run a website, but ultimately, the website has to feel like a destination on its own. You know, you have to know to go there. And what we want to do is create enough energy on the website and enough of an expectation of updating that the thinking on the part of users of our site and of plenty of people who aren't using it yet will be something happened in the world. I can go here for an explanation.
I wonder if you've done any research on that because I think it's very interesting. Point you make that if you're using RSS now, as people increasingly are in all forms, your allegiance is to the content; it's not to the right. to the publisher. And so you tend to read in a drive-by fashion. You know, publishers say newspaper readership in print and online is higher than it's ever been. Well, that's true, but people aren't staying with the newspapers; they're going to the store and then they jump to another newspaper. Do you have I guess evidence of how much allegiance people feel to a destination online versus whether their allegiance is increasingly to the content?
Yeah, I think we have, we do. I think everybody has that, and I think it's exactly what you said. It's unfortunately low. I think that the allegiance is to the content, and all you have to do is think about you yourself. Even the journalist who's really loyal to his newspaper, loves his newspaper, as we do at the Monitor, or, you know, as plenty of people at the Globe did, where I just came from. You know, you still go home at night and you read in a promiscuous fashion, and you don't go to a site just because you love it. You go to a site if it repays you with content that you care about, so I think the atomization of kind of more holistic content that's carried within the brand of a news organization is happening at a very rapid pace, and it's not just happening at newspapers. It's also happening at broadcast sites, and increasingly, as you know, multimedia search becomes more and more powerful as time goes on, you're going to see that, which is why, you know, in broadcast you have a good proactive strategy is the creation of sites like Hulu, for instance, so that you know that that's happening rather than letting YouTube disaggregates you. You can, and in turn aggregate to themselves the content. You actually want to steal a march on them and do that yourself. So you need to always have strategies like that to understand that you can't change user behavior. You can only try to understand it enough and then sync up with it. And in the process, you don't want to sell your soul. I mean, you can go for cheap page views.
Right.
You know that. Britney Spears gets you the cheap page views.
Yeah, but those visitors won't come back.
They won't come back. Yeah. And it's not you in the end. You know, they've got to come back to your content. They've got to come back to what you deliver.
You obviously understand a lot about search, and as search, I would suspect that you, like most publishers, probably find that 80% of your traffic comes from search. How does that affect your thinking about the monitor as a destination versus, because if you assume that people are keyword driven now, they're using their Google alerts or they're using their RSS readers, how important is it to be a destination? Maybe it's important just to have a lot of content and the destination doesn't really matter.
Well, I think there's a point to that. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that may be the tide that's coming in, and I don't know that you can do much about it. I think all you can do is make the site as interesting and as sticky as possible. So you have to use all the best techniques. You have to understand eye tracking. You have to understand ways of helping people get involved in related content. And also, I think there's a role for a good site like the Monitor, like csmonitor.com, and again, other good brands, going back to boston.com, to essentially be portals into the world. You know, if we're a brand that people trust, if they know they're going to come to us for clear-headed, sober news of the world, non-alarmist, but help you understand the world. Okay, so that's our value proposition, as it were. And we cannot just deliver that out of our own notebooks, but we can point to sites throughout the internet that are similar to ours. We become a kind of a jumping off place. We become a brand, and that's not what you're going to find when you go to the article page. When you go through search and you land on the article, you may get prompts to go to related content and you may get prompts to go to our site. But if you get the feeling that, you know, if I want to understand the world and I go to this site, it's going to give me some very interesting links, too, to go to other parts of the world that are sort of not exactly like it, but they've already seen some value in. And you know how big the web is, and you know how much content there is. I think there's a real function in being a kind of, a porter, in a sense, to opening doors. And that's a journalistic function. That's a kind of a broad aggregation of content and links. It's an outbound strategy.
And you spent many years in newspapers. How attuned to the type of mentality you're talking about are most journalists, most veteran journalists?
You know, Paul, I'd say that 4 years ago, when I was just coming off of, I was the political editor, the national political editor in the 2004 presidential race for the Globe. Just coming off of that, I'd say that, you know, a lot of newspaper journalists, especially the ones who were the veterans, were still fairly skeptical of the web. And that is not to say that that's a good thing. That was a pretty bad thing because it was obvious to users all over the place, including these people's kids, and including these people themselves in the evenings, that the web was here. It was the thing. So, but there was a sea change about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. A lot of people source it to the Rupert Murdoch, famous Rupert Murdoch speech to ASNY, I think it was. Go back and look. He basically had this fire and brimstone speech to newspaper editors in which he told them that they had better understand that their business model was broken and that, you know, the disruption of the web was dramatic and it was not cyclical. And I'll try to find the reference for you. But around that time, thinking changed in newsrooms. And by the time I came in, this would have been about 2.5 years ago, to be the multimedia editor of the Globe. There were plenty of journalists out there, plenty of old veteran journalists who understood, who saw the writing on the wall, who were reading every day, Your Site or Romanesco or any number of places. And, if nothing else, journalists are attuned to cultural trends, especially right. when it has to do with self-interest. And this was their self-interest. So I would say that, I would say there are always going to be some people who want to be kicking and screaming and hate the fact that that print is dying and that that their way of working and their way of telling stories has changed. I suspect it's probably always been that way through any technological change, even within the print world over time, from linotype to cold type to whatever. But they really aren't very outspoken these days. I see much more people clamoring, again, at every newspaper I know of, including the Monitor, people clamoring for training, for, just give me the skill set so that I can tell stories in a multi-platform, multimedia way. Should I learn Final Cut Pro? Should I... I've never blogged before. What's our blogging tool? Can I be a blogger, and how does that work? And what's the best protocol for clearing comments? And there's a lot more conversation like that, like practical, how do I get in the game conversation than, I'm just not interested and I wish it would all go away. I mean, I'm afraid, unfortunately, that the series of layoffs over the past, buyouts over the past 5 years, increasingly over the past 3 years, has pretty much meant that the generation that hasn't wanted to be in this game has left or is on the verge of leaving.
It's interesting. So you're quite positive. I mean, you see that you saw a mindset shift go on. You were inside at that point and a big newspaper and saw that change take place.
Yeah, in terms of the culture of newsrooms, I don't think you have a lot of resistance to this change. I think there's a lot of frustration with the slowness of the change in some ways, and also a lot of trepidation about the about really the fundamental question in most newspapers, which is the lifeboat going to fit us all? Because we know that the lifeboat of the web, in terms of what a web advertising dollar earns versus an old print advertising dollar, it's maybe 30% the size, right? I mean, in terms of revenue, if you
That's
just look at...
Optimistic based on what numbers I've heard, but it's a tiny percentage question.
So how does that... Okay, you don't have as much... you don't have as much of a cost structure, but at newspapers with a big legacy of print trucks, Teamsters contracts, forests in Canada, ink... I mean, there's a lot of embedded cost. If the key, going back to how we started, if the key is to sustain the journalistic mission of an organization, whether it's hyperlocal, local, national, or in our case, global, then we just need sufficient revenue to do that. We don't need sufficient revenue also to keep all the other, the printing presses going and so forth. And so the internet gives you that opportunity to do this on in a relatively low cost way, to essentially move out of the industrial model and into the information model. And we're all doing that. We've all got websites. We're definitely in that game. But it's just harder at other newspapers. The news organizations like Politico and the global news operation that Phil Balboni is doing, Charlie Sennett, also a Globe guy, the ProPublica model, all of those are starting with no sunk costs, and they've got startup costs. What they also don't have, generally speaking, is brand. The Monitor has brand. I mean, we are known for something. We're respected around the world. So that's a great advantage right now. And because we're a nonprofit, and even the ones that hope to be for-profit, like Phil's operation, they're going to start as nonprofits to begin.
Sure.
We already understand that world. We're not being forced to kind of, hit numbers we're only trying to hit the numbers that will make it sustainable. So all we've got to do is demonstrate enough revenue to keep our operations going. And then, you know, over time, I'd like to see the revenue grow so that we can expand our operations, right, so we can do more. But we're not having to turn back, you know, big amounts of money to our shareholders.
So check and be sure that this hasn't died in the process, because you're saying great stuff here. What
would you say then? You sound optimistic. What would you say then to the skeptics who say that we're mortgaging the rights of our citizens to know investigative journalism is not economically sustainable anymore, the quality of journalism will decline, and our public officials will not have their feet held to the fire, and so this is a disaster from a public information perspective?
I think I would agree with them. I think from a public information perspective, the breaking of the business model of old-school journalism, old-school print journalism, and the big question mark about where everybody's going in the future is a disaster, because it does threaten investigative journalism. It does threaten global news coverage. It just threatens the carrying on of the mission of just basically vital journalistic coverage of anything, because it's not clear that there's money in it, that's a real danger to society. Now, there are going to be plenty of people who are going to be dancing on the graves of journalists. I understand that, and they enjoy that, and that's okay. That's, it's a big world, and everybody can mix it up. But ultimately, somebody's got to be out there looking at things dispassionately, actually pouring through records, databases, and trying to understand what exactly happened at a city council meeting. And it's great to have citizen journalists. Wonderful. But they're generally not dedicated day after day to covering budget hearings, understanding them, and writing about them dispassionately. And so the loss of those assets as newspapers cut back, that is a disaster. I agree. And all I can say is that our ability at the Monitor and any other newspaper that is taking these steps, our ability to reposition ourselves doesn't solve the problem for the whole industry. The whole industry is going through a big upheaval, and I think it really has implications, Paul, for other parts of the country. I mean, some parts of our state or some parts of our nation that are more rural that might have had, it's going to sound a little arrogant, but they might have had journalists from a capital city newspaper that was a little bigger, had a little more money, and they might have actually had state reporters that traveled out to outlying counties and did stories. Maybe they even had bureaus out there. In many cases, those are shut down. And who's keeping a watch on the county commissioners out there that used to be part of the bread and butter of a newspaper that was making money hand over fist through classified ads, but could afford to carry on its books the reporters who are out looking at that kind of local news? I mean, I wish it were citizen journalists. I hope it is. Something tells me that you can't count on them.
Are you familiar with the story of this woman in Alaska who lived in the town where Sarah Palin grew up and was very active in local politics and knew Sarah Palin very well and published this open letter basically, rather matter-of-factly stating what Palin's record was, what her image was in the town.
Right.
It was a negative letter, but it was not... an attack. I mean, a lot of it was factual information. Are you familiar with that story?
Yeah.
Is that, in fact, can you take that model and project it and say that could become the small-town reporter?
Well, I think it has to become the small-town reporters, and I think that's all we have now. And maybe, maybe there's a way that someone who's smart enough to kind of create a coalition of websites that are of bloggers that you could vet what they say so that it doesn't just seem like a polemic or an ad hominem kind of attack, which, is always suspect. And listen, I know that's also suspect with mainstream journalism, too.
I know what
the knock is, yeah. But maybe you could organize a kind of a coalition, and maybe you could actually do a kind of a federation underneath a news brand to do that. That's what I think that's what some of these hyper-local and community journalism models are trying to do. Like Boston.com, I think they're trying to do that at the Globe and Boston.com with their new community operation that Teresa Hanifin's working on. But it's a lot of tough work, and it's a revolving door. And when you don't pay people, it's hard for those people to even keep their activities going, much less stay loyal to the task of, you know, staying objective.
Right.
Is there a model where they could get enough page views and they could do a revenue share, or they themselves would just generate the page views through Google Ads? I don't know that there's enough money in that. Actually, you would know better than I. Is there enough money in it to be sustainable if you just did Newspaper Death Watch?
No.
So, okay.
No one wants to. I've never had an offer of advertising on the site because nobody wants to be associated with what they perceive as a negative message.
Yeah.
That's a different model. I was never in that to make money with it. I think that if I was doing, I happen to live in Framingham. If I was doing FraminghamNews.com, I would think that I could. There'd be a lot of businesses in town that would like to pay something to be there. And you look at, I've written about some small operations. There's one in upstate New York where there's this one guy, you know, who's essentially aggregating from all over his area, is beating newspapers and established newspapers that have been around for 75 years. And he doesn't need much advertising revenue to do that. Because, as you said, his costs are practically zero.
Isn't Barista? How's Barista doing? Is it?
I don't know what their situation is.
I mean, and then Wicked Local, of course, which is a different, slightly different model because it's more of a corporate model through Gatehouse. I think the jury's still out on their success. I mean, they certainly had a good launch, but
I think that the question really here is in the cost model, and you sort of put your finger on it earlier. If you take out all of the embedded costs that print publishers have, how much are you really left with? I mean, the cost of technology is practically zero, so your production costs are very low. You're really just left with content costs.
Yeah.
Is that sustainable with advertising?
Yeah, and then you have to think a little bit on the content costs, whether it's you could just have a core group of editors and you could be buying your content from the best reporters out there. But over time, as an editor, you also know that you need
continuity.
You need to be able to call the guy in London and say,
relationships.
Yeah, right. We really need that story. And you got to do that story because,
right.
And so you need staffers. And so there is a need for star players who are very much on the franchise players on the team. But I think you're right that if you can get rid of the bricks and mortar costs as much as possible and the industrial back end, then those are jobs too. So I don't want to sell them short either. I mean,
there has to be pain in the process. There's no question it's going to be painful.
Right.
But the question is, on the other end, is there a model that's sustainable?
I think there is. I think it's smaller. Every newsroom is getting smaller, and I just hope that there can be more newsrooms out there that will help compensate. So if our newsroom or the Globe's newsroom shrinks, as it has been, then is there possibly room for another player out there, a kind of a political player type who can come in, or maybe this coalition of, websites that you mentioned, and maybe that whole combination gives you coverage of your local area but it won't be on a par with the previous coverage. It'll just be a different kind of coverage.
Right. When you lose something, essentially, newspapers run their investigative units at a loss because
right.
No one's paying to support that. So you take that loss leader out of the equation. How do you reinvent that as a profit? Right now, essentially, news organizations are having to move to sustain everything that they do profitably.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tricky. And I think the ProPublica model is interesting because I don't know that they themselves, as a site, are going to be self-sustaining, assuming they even get to self-sustaining. So they're partnering, And I think the global news operation Phil and Charlie are working on also has partnerships that they're developing. And that, in a sense, what they're doing, and I don't mean anything negative about this, but in a sense, they're essentially becoming the outsource for newspapers that can no longer. But they're an outsource in a way that is not controlled enough by the local newspaper. So if I'm the editor of a local newspaper and I have a big scandal in my town, can I really count on ProPublica? Or if I have maybe I could count on Global News or The Monitor or whatever to provide the information. But I don't have the ability to follow my soldier in Afghanistan.
Right.
You know?
Right. You can't, well, as you said, I can't call you up and make you do the story.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about your cost model. Now, you have, these foreign bureaus have got to be very expensive to maintain. You have full-time dedicated staff in these eight bureaus?
Yeah, eight bureaus.
Are you looking at that at how you might change that model to bring those costs down?
I mean, we're always looking at, we're always under pressure to look at costs. And we have, by the way, not just these eight foreign bureaus, but we have a whole collection of people who are on contract who are, you know, kind of another circle around that, who are in areas that we care about, but we probably don't go to as often. And then we have and that's the reason you also have good editors here who have worked these regions. So we have desks. We have a Middle East and Central Asia desk, for instance. And that editor has a Rolodex, essentially, online, that is looking at, that has freelancers all over the world that we have turned to before, and we kind of keep turning to for news. So the costs are not just in the rent that our foreign correspondents are having to pay, the rent differential that we're paying for them, and whatever else there is, you know, the healthcare benefits, the pension, the often schooling benefits, all of those things you have to consider with a staff foreign correspondent. With a contractor, you consider a lot of those, maybe not necessarily all of them. It depends. I'm so new here that I don't know exactly what the differences are, but I'm sure there are some significant differences. And then with a freelancer, you're considering almost none of them, but you're also getting much less loyalty and much less continuity. So, you know, if you really care about the key regions of the world, probably 7 to 9 correspondents is about what you need. You got to be in Latin America, one staffer. Well, you've got to have a network throughout Latin America that staffer can hook into, so that when she flies to Brazil, she knows the story and she's been working with the correspondent who's been filing stories on a freelance basis from Brazil over the past year, and that gets you some access. You've certainly got to have somebody in Africa, especially now, the Middle East, definitely, Central Asia, Europe, China. We have South Asia. So, and we have to have somebody in one of the two major war zones that we have going right now. So those have to be staffers. They have to be protected as much as possible by the corporate backup, you know, by the war zone insurance and the just all the backup that you can offer them. Could we do with one or two less? I'd say we'd like to have one or two more, but that's just me.
But, you know, editor always wants one or two more. Would you advise a high school student today to go into journalism as a career?
I would, but I'd say keep your eyes wide open. You know, I mean, go in and learn. Learn to tell stories and learn flexibility, and also learn as much as possible right now multimedia storytelling skills. Telling a story with video, especially with web video at, you know, maximum 2 minutes, is very different from telling a story in print. The audio track is very different. The images are very important. And also, it's not TV, because TV you could count on, depending on what era we're talking about, you can count on people turning it on and just sitting back and watching. and it would wash over them, and they would watch whether, if they were bored, they might flip to another channel. But man, web video, you know, people are ready. They're just ready to hit that,
so
that forward button. And I've seen web video studies that show that within the first 20 seconds, it just drops off dramatically.
Right.
And so you have to be able to tell the story the right way. But what a great thing, you know, to be able to tell stories in different media and to learn. You know, I sometimes think that the early days of television probably there were a bunch of radio guys, you know, John Cameron Swayze and others who went on television and they used television essentially as radio. They just sat there and they talked.
Right. Well, Murrow was a radio guy.
Murrow, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then Cronkite was really too. Mm-hmm. I mean, an old UPI guy. And then it was probably only in the 60s when you came out with relatively portable video cameras that you started to get TV as TV, you know, images.
Right.
So it took maybe, certainly from the invention of TV, but from, you know, post-World War II, it took probably 10 or 15 years to get to a point where TV was actually telling stories as TV should, and then that's evolved. I think we're in the infancy of web storytelling, of multimedia storytelling, especially when it comes to things like interactivity. Can you tell a story that is slightly nonlinear? Can you give people a tease that lets them branch off in multiple directions depending on how they want to, that basically thinks like they do when they are looking at the web, that allows them to not just go from beginning to end, but from beginning to multiple options, and then at each option imbibe it in the appropriate way. Is it a particular piece of audio, or is it a particular piece of video, or are the still images so good that you want to page through them, or are the still images put to music or to the reporter's voice, or most exciting of all, is it a searchable database? Is it a thing that is interactive that allows you to take a story that really hasn't been told? I mean, the Boston.com has a fantastic one. They have two recently that they've done. One was on Manny Ramirez and his home runs when he was approaching 500 home runs. And you could just basically reprogram it for any stadium and see exactly where he hit the homers and how far it was. And another one is it's done by a young developer at Boston.com, who, by the way, as his personal email when we hired him from Cron.com was not Newspaper Death Watch, but it was the end of print.
Yeah.
So
yeah, right.
And he developed, along with some other people, the political editor and some other folks at the Globe, developed this application that brings in data from the 2004 and 2006 elections and maps it across the United States. And you can actually, by moving a scrub bar, you can change the turnout of blacks, Latinos, women, people of different ages, and so forth, and it changes the electoral count. So
you could actually see if the black turnout rate was higher in Virginia, it would affect the liberal votes thusly.
Yeah, and at what point does it tip what state? And so, you know, it's not a reporter sitting there telling you we ran these scenarios and scenario one, if I were to do this, it would do this. It's basically saying to a user, to a reader, you know, plunge in and learn for yourself how things would change if turnout was different in these different states. It's not even a story that's been told yet. You know, it's a story that happens at the moment that you interact with it. I mean, to me, that's a really exciting
That is really cool.
Yeah.
Talk about giving people self-service.
In fact, while we're sitting here, I'll show it to you. We can keep talking if you want.
Yeah, I don't want it to, just another 10 minutes or so. So you would advise them to get into journalism with their eyes wide open. But what about the prospect of having staff jobs in the future? I mean, what will the job market be like for young journalists?
It's called the What If Calculator, and it's on Boston.com's political site, and you'll see it pop up here. I think the job prospects are so here it is. There's the way you can change it based on gender, religion, race, and you just move this. Move this, and it changes the electoral votes, and then And at some point, when you
change... So what does the scale refer to? That's turnout and...
It's turnout, and it's whether you're blue or red. So if more Protestants are voting for Obama, suddenly, and then the front page flips...
That's clever. <it's weird>,
I mean, Paul, I guess I'd say that... I'd say in the end, there's always going to be a need for journalists. And if you're good... and dedicated, there'll be a place for you. There'll be some form of broadcast. There'll be some form of print. There'll be a lot of online. There'll be people who can develop applications like this, who are journalists essentially, who know code. The toolkit for knowing code will become simpler over time. It already is very much simplified, and so there's a. And then there are new places to work. You know, Politico has been hiring recently. The Huffington Post is expanding.
Mm-hmm.
Much smaller scale.
But
yeah,
growing. Yeah,
and they're looking for a certain kind of talent. So I'd say if you just have a passion for the Middle East, that's a great thing. And if you know Arabic, that's a really great thing. But if you took those two things together, and you were a good writer, and you had a multimedia skill set underneath that, it would significantly enhance your saleability, I think, on the job market. And there's probably some way, if somebody like that landed in a part of the world where we had an opening, we might really look at them.
Why'd you take this job?
I thought about it long and hard, and I worked here 20 years ago, so I love it. I mean, I love the mission. I love what they stand for, which is, you know, I've always been partial to the Monitor as a journalistic operation. I would say that the thing that intrigued me the most about taking this job right now with the Monitor is that it seems as though the Monitor is poised to make a great leap that is going to be slightly or even significantly in advance of what other mainstream news organizations do, that we're in a select pool. And as I analyzed it, it just seemed like the right challenge. I mean, to be able to help lead an organization like this into a new media business model that would, you know, as we talked about, that would be sustainable and that would be not ahead of the times, but exactly in tune with the times, you know, I think that would be, that just seemed like a great challenge. Plus, I like the idea of being the editor, in a sense, of being able to marshal the resources. I mean,
of being in charge, of not having to evangelize multimedia and new media to the organization, but actually being able to make that happen.
Now, I have to say at the Globe, and you know, this is going to sound like I'm sending flowers over there, but there's no editor in American journalism that is more forward-thinking about web stuff than Marty Baron. I mean, this guy is a great journalist, but he's also very web-savvy. So he was great to work with. It's just that it was a very large organization, and I understood it fairly well, and I really liked it, but it's the nimbleness of the Monitor that appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if it can act as a model in any way for other American newspapers, for other newspapers as they make this transition, then I think that's to the good. And I'm hoping that that's something that I can share with people. I'll be down at the Poynter Institute in November talking to them about it. There's some people from USC that are interested. So there are people who are kind of monitoring the Monitor right now, and I hope we do justice to it as a kind of a model.
How big is your staff?
We have 100 reporters, editors, and I think we have actually the number is like 99. So I'd say 100.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I certainly think you do have an opportunity. I remember several years ago, I used to visit this building regularly because the Monitor took a brief and fairly disastrous jump into broadcast. Of course, that was pre-web. Do you see that? I mean, could you do something like that again, but using these much lower cost technologies that are available to you now?
Well, yeah, I think the the problem with broadcast is, what was Fred Friendly's great line? It's a 600-pound pencil. You know, it's in those days.
I've never heard that one.
Right. In those days, especially, it just required so much capital investment to build the studio, to get the uplinks, the satellite time, the transmitters, whatever. So that, in some ways, was the industrial model. So newspapers are right now their business model is being attacked by the relative simplicity and the disruption of the internet. So is broadcast and web video, I think, and the ability to kind of cheaply create video and other things for the web is something that news organizations, whether they're in print or broadcasting, should definitely take advantage of. So, yeah, to the extent that we do web video, we are essentially broadcasters. We do podcasts. We're essentially radio. You know, as we get better at it and as more people sort of turn to web video, I mean, I take my laptop home and I sit there in the evenings, my wife and I do, and we don't really watch TV much. You know, I mean, we might watch 30 Rock or something, but you know, we don't really watch. We don't even do much appointment TV because it's all sort of available. You know, if you want to watch Saturday Night Live, you don't have to watch the whole thing. You can just watch that Tina Fey, Sarah Palin thing that was on Hulu or was on NBC.com. And I think that the ability to do video, the ability to do essentially broadcast, but not old school, not with, you know, stand-ups and anchor desks and other kinds of associated programming that you're hoping to kind of hook people to. But, you know, this is the video that you need to know to understand this particular thing about China right now. This is it. And that video can be unhooked from the story. It can be linked to the story. It can be its own thing. We're in that business right now. We're in the broadcast business. It's just that we're not doing it over the airwaves, and we're not really doing it over cable. We're doing it over the internet, which is cable in a sense in most cases.
But the way you tell a story, when you have an audience that can immediately jump to any part of the story and can leave whenever it wants, you have to tell that story very differently. I mean, a podcast is not radio.
Right.
Podcast listeners start at the beginning, and they may or may not leave in the middle.
Yeah.
Radio, you assume that you have sort of a random access audience. People are coming and going
right
at times. So that affects the way you tell the story. So
yeah.
You think about it differently than you would even broadcast.
You do. Yeah, you do. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the future... I understand. I mean, I drive to work every day, so I understand the kind of, you know, hitting the dial on radio, too, and you're scanning all the time for something interesting to listen to. I think that when and if you have much more kind of built-in podcast capability in new cars, a bunch of satellite radio seem to have that promise, but I'm not sure where it's going now. You can essentially be listening to podcasts of things that could be better than what you would get, you know, in the FM band and the occasional AM band as you're driving from the South Shore up to Boston, as I do every day. And that would be pretty good, and that's technology that could easily be an embedded part of the automobile in the next few years. You know,
right.
I don't think so.
Right.
So we'll play in that market, and we'll certainly play in the web video market. But I think the way you that goes back to one of the reasons why we want to have a website that is itself a destination. Because if it's a destination, then we can offer our videos not just in a disembodied way to people who are searching, but we can actually offer an entire video experience. We can pull together, you know, six videos that tell the story of the six major conflicts in the world that we happen to have done over the past 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we can offer that as a viewing experience. And, you know, I don't know if your habits are like mine, but if sometimes Sometimes you're just looking for specific information, which is why you do a web search. And sometimes you just want to go horizontally across the web. I'm interested in this video. You know, that video makes me interested in other videos. So we need to be able to offer that. You know, it really is the end of the captive audience, basically, is what we're talking about.
That's what it comes down to. And it's that's a scary thing, because for 200 years, publishers have enjoyed certain subscribers and captive audiences, and you had their attention every day.
Yeah.
And now they are in control, and so we have to adjust what we do.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
So we have to understand them.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome,
I'll let you
Paul.
Go now.
This was great.
There you have it, John Yema, editor of the Christian Science Monitor, and a man who has a very clear vision of the future, who's very tuned in to where media is going, and I think we'll do some great things at that newspaper. Thanks for joining us. Please be sure to submit any comments on this interview or anything else to the comments field at Newspaper Death Watch. I'm Paul Gillen.